following interview is brought to you by the Mile High Sanity Project. You're in it.
All right, welcome to the Mile High Sanity Project. I'm here with my co-host Norman Schultz.
Well, hello.
Nick Arcus.
Hey, everyone.
My name's Chalmer Wren. On a previous episode, we had talked a little bit about the placebo effect on our complementary and alternative medicine episodes. And today we have a very special guest with us to talk to us a little bit more about the placebo effect. We can get a little bit more in depth. We have with us today Dr. Morgan Levy. Welcome to the show. We're glad to have you. Dr. Levy received his Bachelor of Science degree in psychology from Texas A&M University and a medical degree from the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. He completed a residency in psychiatry there and fellowships in geriatric psychiatry and neurobehavior at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. He received grant funding from the Veterans Administration to study Alzheimer's disease.
Alzheimer's.
Whatever. He served on the faculty at UCLA and the Wake Forest University Medical Center. He did research on behavioral aspects of dementing illnesses and is published in numerous professional journals. The American Association for Geriatric Psychiatry bestowed on him the title of Best Researcher in Training for his work on Alzheimer's disease.
You keep saying Alzheimer's. This is like quinine. You can't.
How
say
am
it.
I supposed to say it?
Alzheimer's. Or I guess you could. You know, you can just say old dimers. We'll mean the same thing to you.
Old-timers.
Okay. Grandma calls it. I got the old-timers disease.
Morgan Levy has a website at morganlevy.com /WordPress, where you can check out much of the work he does and several of his online books that he's written. So without further ado, we'll get started.
I got a quick question.
Sure.
Geriatric psychiatrist. That's what you did for a living for how many number of years?
I don't know, 17 to 20, something like that.
And here's what I want to know. I'm always interested in this question. What's the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist?
A psychiatrist is a physician.
Okay. So you went to medical school.
That's correct.
Psychologist does not go to medical school.
That's correct.
Okay. One can give you drugs, right? Prescriptions or not?
Well, nowadays anybody can give you drugs. Theoretically, you have to be an MD to give drugs.
Right, to get a prescription. But I guess psychologists will just send you out to buy various other kinds of...
Well, nowadays, psychologists can prescribe. I don't know why.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
I prescribe to you my book.
That's right. That's right. And is it true that psychiatrists, still has its roots in kind of Freudian, or is that not really true?
You can certainly be a Freudian psychoanalyst.
Right.
That's not what I was, though. I was a regular psychiatrist, and then I got interested in brain science in the decade of the 90s and went to UCLA and did a fellowship in neurobehavior and a fellowship in geriatric psychiatry and primarily worked with dementing illnesses. In other words, real brain injury and how that affects your behavior.
Gotcha.
So is this... this expertise in the placebo effect, is that something you gain by necessity, or do you have a particular interest in it?
No, all of the things that I do or that I talk about are the neuroscience of this, that, and the other thing. And so I talk about the placebo effect in regards to the neuroscience. How does your brain function in regards to the placebo effect occurring?
Okay. So in general, could you give us a definition of the placebo effect, what specifically that is?
The definition is extremely
broad.
I don't like the term placebo effect just because it's definitionally difficult. It really is not one single thing. It's multiple different things, and all people talk about it in multiple different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you're speaking my language, the philosopher's language.
Yeah.
I found this is one of the things I remember finding very frustrating when we were doing the original episodes on this, reading about the placebo effect. I couldn't get a grasp really on what it was, like what it did cover and what it didn't cover. I thought it was a hugely broad topic.
Yeah.
The way I would define it is in two major categories of definition. One category would be things that were basically misperception, and the other category would be things that actually caused brain function to occur that resulted in physiological responses that institute or that create a compensatory brain mechanism to occur. So I think those are the two basic different kinds of placebo effect.
Hmm. Okay.
So the first one being just a person gets better for some other reason than the treatment that is being, and it could be any number of reasons, but it's just the person isn't realizing what's going on.
Yeah, it's sort of like politics. You know, you just sort of, something good happens and you take credit for it.
Right. Right. I gotcha.
I like the term inert agent. Is that an appropriate term to describe it?
The word inert means that it's not an active agent.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So do you want to start with your questions, Norm?
Well, sure.
Open with the first one.
I've got a list of questions. The first one is, what do you say to people? And I guess before I ask this question, you know, we do want to point out that you have a really solid video on YouTube that we're going to link on the website that gives some kind of basics of the placebo effect in more depth than we're going to here. And you talk a little bit about this definitional problem in more depth as well, as in the different things that could occur that you don't really think should be called the placebo effect, even though currently they are. So hopefully we can incorporate some of that into what we're talking about today, but you know, we want people to look at the video as well. But okay, so here's my first question. What do you say to people who think inducing a placebo is a good thing? So I've run into this.
And I think by that, essentially using it on purpose to is the same way you would medicine to heal people.
What's wrong with it?
Are you saying in place of medicine or just alongside of medicine?
Either way.
Either way.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's an idea that theoretically, I would like to see the placebo effect be used in regular medicine on a routine basis.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, there's lots of problems with doing that. We used to do that, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, and physicians used to frequently give sugar pills to psychosomatic patients or to people that, you know, they felt would respond well to that, and it was just a common practice. But back then, the formulary had about, 12 medicines on it, so... Mm-hmm. Then it was outlawed, and physicians were no longer able to use sugar pills. And for the last 50 years, you know, sugar pills have not been stocked, you know, routinely at drugstores.
Right.
And so, in my opinion, doctors lost. A really beneficial way to treat patients, and how to get that back is sort of a complicated thing that we can sort of talk more about. A lot of the details about that tonight.
Well, and that gives me kind of a follow-up question. I read something about it's called the placebo paradox, that some people have argued that it's unethical to use a placebo in treatment, and other people have argued that if it makes the patient better, it's unethical not to. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you would be closer to the former camp.
Well, the ethical issue, in my opinion, revolves around the idea of deception. Mm-hmm. And clearly, I'm on in the side that you cannot have deception. I don't care what else you're doing in medicine, you can't lie to your patient.
So wait a second. When people used to, a long time ago, when doctors used to prescribe sugar pills, they told their patients that these were sugar pills?
I have no idea. You know, probably some doctors did, and probably some didn't. I would just guess most didn't. But,
right.
Just because we're too busy to make explanations like that to patients. We don't really explain anything to patients.
I think you mentioned in your video, if I remember, that people being completely naive about it doesn't really matter, necessarily.
Not at all. And so my issue is that deception is not a requirement. In fact, if you fully inform the patient that this is a placebo, and you can have equally as effective of a placebo effect as if you're lying to them.
Right.
You simply don't have to lie in order to be able to use the placebo effect. In fact, depending if you select the patient appropriately and you treat the patient with a proper doctor-patient etiquette, you can frequently induce placebo effect or use a placebo effect and cause a patient to get better. And you can actually, you know, patients can actually, you know, practice it and do it more and more and get better at it. It's basically being able to be affected by suggestion.
Right.
And the ability to be affected by suggestion is something that you can practice. For example, with hypnosis, you know, you have much better chance of having an effective hypnotic therapy if the person knows fully what's going on and goes in with eyes open and, right. And even practices it, you know, for example,
because they're not going to resist.
Right. For example, sometimes, you know, on occasion they'll do even open heart surgery with no analgesia, just under the, you know, hypnotic suggestion of analgesia.
Right. Right.
And but that particular individual that is doing that needs to practice it for like 6 months before they're able to do
it. Better.
Yeah, I would imagine. Maybe cut
it.
Themselves a few times, see if they
don't
freak out.
Dry run.
But it's actually a relatively safe procedure. I think people think that, like, if you know, you could like wake up and then all of a sudden feel tons of pain, but that's not the way it works. You know, if you know what you're doing and you're practiced, and it's kind of like practicing meditation or practicing some form of, you know, holistic, you know, basically focus type of. You're in this anesthetized state, and even if you completely woke up from it, you know, it would take a while for the, you know, pain, the anesthesia basically to wear off. It's not something that it's not a dangerous thing to be having someone doing open heart surgery just under analgesia from hypnosis. So the point is that, as with hypnosis, with the placebo effect, you're basically doing the same thing. You're basically putting yourself, allowing your body to respond to suggestion.
Right.
And it's just something that takes practice, and you can learn how to do it, and you can do it collaboratively with a patient, and there doesn't have to be any deception whatsoever. So clearly I agree that deceptive placebo effect is questionable ethically.
Right.
But you don't have to use the deception.
You know, I like your position. I think what you're saying is that you know, why not let doctors use a placebo as long as they're not engaging in deception? I think that would be really interesting. I don't see any particular reason why would be the case.
It seems like it removes any kind of real ethical objection that someone might have to it.
Well, you also have to ask, if something is beneficial to a patient and it's not going to hurt them, would it be unethical to withhold it?
Yeah,
right.
Certainly,
right.
I would think.
Well, there's another issue.
You don't have to worry about side effects.
There's another issue if you're going to use a placebo ethically, in my opinion, without deception.
Yeah.
There's another issue that you would be crossing an ethical boundary if you screwed up, and that is if you used a placebo when a real medicine is what they really needed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, if I'm going to use a placebo, I am not going to use it to treat anything that is a real underlying disease. So, for example, right. If you have cancer and you need a chemotherapeutic agent, I'm not going to give you a placebo.
No acupuncture, no homeopathy.
Right. You get to talk the cancer away. Yeah.
You know, I think that doctors are already under the current, you know, kind of negligence and, malpractice laws. I think they already couldn't do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, and
that would be just prescribing something that wasn't beneficial to them. They could be sued, yeah. Right?
Plus, if I totally was honest with you, you were getting a placebo, but it was to treat cancer, that still wouldn't be very ethical.
Right. Yeah.
So my point is that you have to understand the kinds of things that the placebo effect, you know, can treat. Mm-hmm. If the individual is psychosomatic, which means you have given them all the lab tests, you've examined them, it's your medical opinion that they do not have an illness, mm-hmm. and you're giving them the placebo effect, then it doesn't matter what their, you know, claim is. You know, you have examined them, you have done all the appropriate things, you know, they've come back to you, you know, every week for the last 6 weeks, and everything you've tried doesn't work, and you've really examined them, and there's nothing wrong with them, and, you know, so that would be a basically default position to use the placebo. The other way you could use placebo is if you know that you're treating one of the things that placebos work for, and the things that placebos work for are compensatory brain mechanisms, not underlying pathology. So, for example, if I have a pulmonary infection that's caused by a particular bacteria, you know, a placebo isn't going to kill that bacteria.
No,
right?
No.
Right, right.
But
it could boost your immune system, though, couldn't it?
Exactly. But boosting your immune system doesn't necessarily kill the bacteria.
I gotcha.
Boosting your immune system is causing a compensatory response to the bacteria. Yeah. You have the bacteria in your lungs, your body responds to that by by trying to pump out more immune agents, right?
Right.
But the immune agents don't necessarily kill it. They just basically respond
right.
to it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's what you can do with placebos, is you can cause the chemicals in your brain to have an effect to change chemicals in your body that cause compensatory responses,
right.
not you know, treatments, right? So, for example, let's say I broke my arm and I need my brain to produce endorphins so that my arm doesn't hurt so bad, right?
Right, right.
Well,
right.
you can cause the brain to produce endorphins with hypnosis or with placebo effect, but you can't cause the bone to heal with
right.
placebo.
Right. Makes sense.
So I'd like to mention a little bit more of this term compensatory. In a way, you're saying you can augment an inherent response that you would already have,
right.
but you're not going to treat the underlying illness.
Right. Another example would be if I wanted your brain to produce a certain type of chemical that would cause your gut to feel bad, well, I could just like cuss at you, right?
Yeah.
And that happens. Right? Or if I
do, we want to demonstrate this right now? No.
Well, I almost did, but he has such a baby face.
I am.
Do it to Nick. He's tough.
Yeah.
Sure. So, or the opposite way, I could, you know, compliment you, and you would feel all warm and snuggly inside, right? Mm-hmm. Well, different brain structures and different brain chemicals subserve these feelings, right. that, you know, and so that's the kind of brain effect that I can have without using pharmacological agents.
Okay, and I wanted to bring up a quick example of a study at Harvard Medical School in 2010, where they found that patients with irritable bowel syndrome, which, as I understand it, is predominantly psychosomatic or entirely psychosomatic.
There is certainly a psychosomatic okay. component, but it is. It's arguable, but
okay.
yeah.
Regardless, they experienced significant beneficial effect on a placebo when they were told that they were given a placebo, as mm-hmm. compared to a control group that received no pills at all.
Does it say when that study was?
2010.
Really?
Yeah. The program.
Well, I guess you're allowed to do it studies. When you're doing a study. You just can't do it with your regular patients.
Yeah,
so. Well, no, they do it with studies all the time. In fact, in order for any drug to come to market, it has yeah, to be done with a double-blind placebo-controlled study, which yep. means half the people are getting placebo, yep. and they're told in advance they're going to get placebo, and guess what? They still respond.
Yeah.
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 And that's something we talked about in one
well,
of
the Well, no, wait a second. It can't be double-blind if they're told it's placebo.
Well, they're told that you are either going
you
to
might
get a,
be.
Yeah. you are either going to be in one of two groups. You're either going to get real medicine or you're going to get a placebo.
Right.
And guess what? You know, the placebo response groups are pretty high. That's why they have to keep doing it this way.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Well, so it sounds to me like the answer, just to sum this up, is that you think that the placebo is a good thing as long as there's no deception in treatment. Obviously, there has to be some level of deception in studies, but not in treatment. That sounds like a good answer to me. I like that.
No deception. Or it's used for psychosomatic patient after you've made sure they don't have any real illness,
right,
or you're just trying to initiate a compensatory mechanism rather than actually treating an underlying illness.
You know, in a way, a doctor probably can do this now. They just can't prescribe a sugar pill. If the doctor doesn't find anything wrong with you and thinks that it's psychosomatic, there's lots of things that they can do to induce another form of placebo effect.
Well,
suggest you do a massage therapist or...
I would agree with that statement, except I would only change one word rather than you saying that you think they could. I would say that they are.
Oh, yeah. yes. It's pretty clear.
As a practicing physician, you do that kind of sort of thing on a routine basis, but you sort of define it as sort of being a part of the doctor-patient relationship.
I gotcha.
Yeah. Well, this reminds me of examples where you go in with... You're sick and you get antibiotics, even though you don't necessarily need antibiotics. Mm-hmm. So maybe... You know, over-prescribing medicines that the patient doesn't necessarily need.
That's right. If I'm a family physician and I know you because I've treated you a number of times, and you know I know that you're irritating and you take a lot of time, and you know you come often, and you know, and if I don't give you a pill, you're going to be pissed off and calling me this evening.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to give you an antibiotic whether you need one or not.
Gotcha. So yeah, so that's kind of an example. So even though that is. An actual medicine, it can still be utilized as a placebo because it's inert relative to the illness they don't have.
Right. In fact, a lot of... Yeah.
That's a weird way to think about it.
No, that's exactly correct. I mean, the type of placebo that we normally use isn't a sugar pill. It's not like you give the patient a prescription, they go to the pharmacy and they get a sugar pill. That's illegal. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. The way we normally give placebos is basically to give treatments, you know, that are effective treatments, but maybe not for this particular patient in this particular illness.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, do you want the next question?
Yeah,
okay.
I'll do the next question.
You're up.
We'll have Nick do the one after that.
You're up to bat.
What's the most off-wall example of the placebo effect that you've heard? I know.
Oh, you're asking? Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that.
We're just switching questions.
Okay.
I asked a couple of my questions in this last round. You just didn't notice.
So, all right, yeah.
Now, when you say off the wall, do you mean like off the wall funny, or do you mean like off the wall serious and screwed somebody up really bad?
Let's do both.
I'd like to hear both.
Yeah. I think we need both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're familiar with what I call placebo medicine, that is complementary and alternative or holistic or whatever word you
placebo
want to use.
Placebo-based.
We did a whole episode.
You know, there's a long laundry list of really horrible outcomes, you know, that are a direct result of somebody giving a fake placebo treatment that, you know, to somebody who actually needed a real treatment. For example, the Laetril thing comes to mind. You know, these people that have cancer, they go to Mexico, they get Laetril from this clinic, and that, you know,
I don't know what this is.
Laetril.
Give us a little background.
Yeah. It's a fake anti-cancer treatment that was outlawed after a few years. They figured out that it absolutely does not treat cancer, and so a few people decided that it still does, and so they weren't allowed to do it in the United States, so they went to Mexico and set up clinics.
Huh.
And so lots of people, like, what's that famous actor?
The comedian. Right?
There's a comedian, I think, too.
Yeah.
But no, I'm talking about he was a dramatic actor from back in the 50s and 60s. Anyways, there's a lot of people that went to Mexico to get treatment and, you know, died. but then there's also, if you go on the internet to a site called Quackwatch.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, you can go on there and you can find, very well chronicled, horrible abuse problems that have occurred secondary to people getting fake treatment.
The rise and fall of Laetril.
Steve McQueen.
Yep. Steve McQueen. That's
Steve
McQueen.
Oh,
I have no idea.
I didn't know that either.
I didn't know about this either.
Yeah.
What is the treatment? Is it a drug or is it a regimen of some sort? Or
they say it's a vitamin, but
oh, okay. So it was a pill that people were taking.
I can tell you what it is right now. It's called amygdalin, and it's a glycoside initially isolated from the seeds of the tree Prunus dulcis.
This is for the chemistry geeks that are listening to the show, if there are any.
Also known as bitter almonds. And it's a... Yeah, it's a big, scary-looking organic molecule. I see some cyanide on there. That's what.
Yeah, apricots have a little bit of cyanide.
Yeah, and in fact, it is not an inert. One of the biggest problems is with placebo medicine things that actually aren't inert. And this is one of them. It can actually harm you if you take it incorrectly or too much.
It's actually sometimes sold under the name vitamin B17.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
It doesn't look like a vitamin to me. Right. I'm staring at the structure. That's not
used incorrectly. This is a poison. So
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Well,
it's similar to placebo. They both start with P.
Another example, I don't know if I mentioned this in our last episodes on AIDS denialism, is there have been illegal trials on vitamins in South Africa for AIDS.
Oh, yeah.
They've done trials on African potatoes and all kinds of alternative medicines, and actually there's ads in the papers there to go and get treated by these things to cure your HIV or your AIDS.
It's funny, people have this this belief that a vitamin automatically means that it's not something that you can overdo. It's not something that you can have to worry about. That's not true, is it?
Yeah, the reason I believe that they called it a vitamin is because, you know, when it was originally in clinical trials, the side effect profile was significant and the effect profile was basically zero.
Right.
And so it had a reputation of being a drug that had bad side effects, and so they wanted it to sound safe, so they called it a vitamin.
Yeah.
That's all you got to do, really. I still can't believe that people thought that potatoes would solve their problems.
You mean in AIDS?
Right. But if it could, man, I mean, I'll tell you, Idaho would be a very powerful state.
No, it's only African potatoes.
Ah, that's true.
Yeah. So, well, that's a scary example. Can you, and if you can, that's fine, but I was wondering if you knew of any funny ones. Any that come to mind?
Oh, geez.
Anything that you just look at and you just think, wow, I can't believe people bought that.
Oh, man, I could definitely come up with one. I don't know if I'll be able to on the spot.
Well, maybe we'll come back to
it. Yeah, I tell you what, let's keep going, and I'll kind of try and think of a funny example.
Sounds good.
And actually, if you're on Quack Watch, you might be able to find a funny. Well, most of those examples aren't funny.
Yeah, he's kind of serious.
He's kind of serious, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, I'm sure I can come up with one, but give me a minute.
All right.
Please, Darwin, we'll find something on the Darwin Awards.
Yeah. Oh, the Darwin Awards. Yeah. That would be a perfect place for that.
Uh-oh. Yeah. We're having an episode where we're Googling while talking. This is dangerous.
That's every episode.
No, it's not. Shh.
So, well, let's forget it. Okay. Want to go on to another question?
Yeah, sure.
Right. Well, I mean, another one we had within was, what do we not understand about the effect?
Yeah, and the common, you know, I mean, there are a lot of people like us that are critical thinkers. We're not experts necessarily in this kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of skeptics out there that are familiar with the placebo effect. For people that aren't newbies with the placebo effect, you know, what's maybe your top thing that people don't realize about it?
Well, I think a lot of the things that I've just said are generally not things that are at the forefront of people's mind. I think the majority of people think that deception is a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
I did actually.
I did at some point. I think actually before you corrected me.
Yeah.
I was under that impression.
I think the idea that you could that the placebo effect is basically, in my opinion, a similar mechanism of action compared with psychotherapy, with and when I talk about psychotherapy, I'm talking about the types of psychotherapy that we know actually cause compensatory responses, like for the cognitive behavioral psychotherapy that we know can treat obsessive compulsive disorder, depressions, sure, and things like that, through eliciting the same type of compensatory mechanism.
All based on talking about one's problems in a particular way,
right,
looking at them in a certain way.
Right, with no pharmacological agents.
Right.
Hypnosis, placebo effects, and alternative. The idea that all these things basically have the same mechanism of action, I think, is an idea that, you know, a lot of people don't quite understand well. And I think a lot of the things that we've just been talking about are kind of misperceptions.
Yeah. Yeah. I know I was surprised when I heard this first from James Randi, that the placebo effect works better on smart people.
Yeah.
And we've heard this from you as well, I think.
Yeah.
I have a question. Being a psychologist or psychotherapy reminded me of this. Have you heard the term nocebo?
Yes.
Or the negative placebo effect.
Absolutely,
I'm curious. I've heard it lumped with the placebo effect on the whole and considered a separate thing. To me, it seems like it's just putting something in a different direction.
Well, the idea of a nocebo is that you can actually cause harm with the placebo effect. So basically, think of all these compensatory mechanisms, like analgesia, inflammation, nausea, anything that your brain does as a compensation to illness, right? You can elicit through the placebo effect, right? You can also elicit it bad, right?
Right.
So let's say I can give you a placebo that will reduce your pain. Can I give you a placebo that will cause you to feel bad pain? Yeah. You can do it. It goes either way.
And this kind of brings up the ethics thing again. It seems that if I were a psychologist or a psychiatrist talking to a patient, that there are ways that I could talk about my problems or bring things up that would actually cause me to feel worse about them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, soapbox, sorry. I was about go off.
You are allowed to go off. If we don't like it, we'll just edit it out, but we probably like it.
Yeah. In regards to traditional Freudian types of Jungian, that sort of psychotherapy, there's a huge amount of questionable psychotherapy out there that you can go and pay for and receive.
The technical term we use here is bullshit.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
And the thing is that for whatever reason, people think if they're doing psychotherapy, it's like a vitamin, that you cannot hurt somebody with it, right?
Couldn't hurt.
Right. But psychotherapy is something that clearly can be detrimental.
You know, this might not be a good example, but I immediately thought of, do you remember a few years ago, there was some person who was trying to do like a... I think a little girl got killed when she was doing some kind of therapy where they wanted to like have her be like reborn.
They're pushing
on her with like, and they suffocated her.
I mean, she physically died because they were pushing on her. But so that's a little bit different.
It's different. It's just like the kind of crazy ideas that people might go for.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That was a psychotherapy. The idea was that you have a child who has a behavioral problem. You need, in order to change that behavioral problem, this person needs to go back into the womb and be reborn. And so they had this elaborate way of, you know, with steam and heat and suffocation inside of a contraption or something. And they accidentally killed the kid.
Right. Yeah, but they didn't kill her with the power of the mind. It's they killed her by suffocating her,
So. They killed her by cutting off power to her mind.
Well, this, I mean, I know there have been studies published on this, you know, different things. If you talk about things that make you angry.
Well, the point was the effect, it was doing the psychotherapy that killed her.
I understand.
But this reminds me, I mean, there's been studies published that show that if you have anger management problems, talking about the things that make you angry can kind of piss you off. Depending on...
Wait, let me get this straight. Talking about the things that make you angry might make you angry?
Make you angry.
Weird.
Well, what you're talking about is that typically in psychotherapy, if you're a good, qualified, real psychotherapist, you don't necessarily just, you know, treat every patient the same way.
Right.
So some patients, it might be really good to get them to bring out, you know, whatever pain they're experiencing. Other patients, you might not want to go there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if this is a side question, but I don't actually think it is. I was just thinking that I'd like to hear from you about a practice in psychotherapy that you think is harmful in this way. It sounds to me
how much time we got?
Well, maybe just one. I don't know. I'm interested in this. I saw the look on your face when this was brought up. So
we have the soapbox here, so that's good.
I'd like to hear maybe just one example of something that psychotherapists or, you know, psychiatrists do that you think is inducing a negative placebo.
A little bit on the spot, so let me just talk about them in general.
I
think some of the overall global issues that people kind of misperceive and therefore end up using psychotherapy incorrectly. Psychotherapy generally, you know, there's no medication involved, there's no physical treatment involved, except I guess if you're gonna rebirth somebody.
Gets physical.
Right. But generally, there's no touching the patient involved.
Right.
You're talking, right? You're having communication, which means the healing mechanism or the healing process has to do with interpersonal relationship. The physician or the therapist and the patient develop an interpersonal relationship where something happens and the patient, you know, overcomes something or has a positive outcome, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think of your personal lives and all the relationships you've ever had with anybody, right? Is a human relationship something that always works out great?
No,
certainly not.
Right? Certainly not.
Yeah. If the therapist brings an agenda, or if their therapist brings an idea of how to treat the patient that's like one size fits all.
Uh-huh.
A friend of mine used to say, you know, if you go to a brown shoe salesman, you're probably going to end up buying a pair of brown shoes.
Sure.
So if you're that kind of psychotherapist that's basically selling one kind of psychotherapy to fit all problems, if you are a psychotherapist who just had a bad day yesterday, and right. You know, and so you don't have a particular as good of a relationship with your patients that day as you want. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, problems that can occur in a relationship, and all of those kinds of problems can occur in a psychotherapeutic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why interactive psychotherapy types of psychotherapy kind of aren't, you know, I think are. I mean, if you interact in a way that I think is more, in this day and age, reasonable, You interact in a way where you're actually teaching the patient how to do certain types of activities to help them overcome things.
Right.
Those types of therapies are like cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, where you're teaching them how to do worksheets, how to do breathing exercises.
A little more practical.
A little more practical stuff here and now, and you're teaching them how to overcome anxiety or how to overcome negative thought processes that happen when people are depressed. And you're doing that, giving them some behavioral things to overcome, you know, to relaxation therapies and that type of interaction is fine, right?
Right.
But if you're doing traditional Freudian psychotherapy, you really need to be reserved. You need to be a blank slate. You need to be, you know, everything that happens in the session has to be patient initiated.
Right.
But a lot of psychotherapists just can't help themselves.
Sure.
and a lot of official forms of psychotherapy that aren't as good, you know, involve. Direct.
Too much suggestion.
I gotcha. Yeah, and so the patients that you get generally aren't guys or girls who are very confident and who are A personalities and who are capable of, you know, doing. You know, it's usually people that are more, you know, affected by authority figures telling them what to do and that sort
of
thing. So it's easy to direct patients and to get them to do what you want them to do rather than what they really need to do to get better. So basically I'm just sort of going through a whole bunch of ideas about things just in general. And I'm not talking about any specific therapy, but just generally the mistakes, you know, that people can make in that type of a therapeutic relationship.
Sure. I think that if you do decide that you are going to get yourself into therapy, you need to initially shop for a therapist. Make sure that you are interacting well with your therapist. Make sure that they're, you know, listening and having a little bit more of a perspective of things coming from you,
right,
et cetera.
And don't get me wrong. I'm not poo-pooing all of psychotherapy. I mean, there are lots of psychotherapists out there that are doing a really good job, and there's, you know, but yeah, I would say, like in the city of Denver, you know, half the therapists, you know, I wouldn't send my best friend to. So, you know, you really need to shop around. You really need to find, and if you're not doing one of the APA approved. Big APA, the American Psychiatric, not American Association. If you're not doing one of the proven beneficial forms of therapy,
right,
you know, then you're really doing something that could have benefit on a long-term basis, you know, through the relationship, but isn't necessarily something that has evidence that it's beneficial.
Sure.
Okay.
Makes sense.
Kind of reminds me of the idea of in philosophy, the concept of a truly objective observer. Being a therapist with somebody, having a relationship, but without having that investment that can cause you to give bad therapy, seems like it would be difficult in general.
Yeah. Well, it's not the same as a friendship. It's not.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's hard to draw that line, I think.
I would imagine. Yeah.
Training, I imagine it takes some kind of schooling.
One would hope that they would send them to that.
Oh, here's an idea that you guys are actually bringing up. There's the idea of counter-transference. Do you know?
I've not heard of that.
Let me see if I got this right. I think I know what it is. So transference is when a patient develops an affectionate, probably, relationship.
It doesn't have to be affectionate. It can be any sort of emotional.
Emotional attachment or reaction.
It could be anger. Hatred. It could be hatred.
Okay.
It could be love. It could be whatever.
And toward their therapist.
Right.
And counter is when the therapist starts to develop those feelings, could be positive, could be negative, but personal as far as to their patient.
We've all seen one about Bob. This is how it happens.
And the thing of it is that the idea is that, you know, in the psychotherapeutic relationship, you just have two people, right? The therapist and the patient, right? And so if the patient is, and ideally the therapist isn't revealing anything of himself.
Right.
He's got a flat face. He's not emotional.
Right.
And a lot of times the patient can't even see the therapist. You're sitting off to the side or something. The therapist isn't actively involved. You know, it's the patient that's doing everything, right?
Didn't Freud have people turn their back on him?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think
so.
Yeah.
But the point is that everything's coming from the patient, right? And so if the patient decides that the therapist is this mean, awful, bully person, it's not because the therapist is a mean, awful, bully person. It's because there was transference going on. He transferred stuff in his life onto the therapist, right?
Right.
Well, the therapist can do the same thing. Let's say if you're the psychotherapist for, name some really beautiful woman.
Scarlett Johansson?
Sure.
I'm trying.
So let's say you're her psychotherapist, right? And you fall in love with her. Well, you're not really falling in love with her. You're just falling in love with her tits.
Right.
So that's transference back from the... obviously, it's a well-known fact that...
But Scarlett Johansson has nice tits, yeah.
Well, yeah, right. Yeah. But also, it's a well-known fact that psychotherapists, frequently engage in sex with their patients.
Really?
And
really?
That's why, because...
Wait, time out. No. I thought that was so taboo, it almost never happened.
It's super, super taboo because it always happens.
Seriously?
Norm, have you ever heard of happy ending psychotherapy?
I did not know that. Huh.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to start.
You're going to the wrong psychologist, my friend.
So I should start hunting for a very attractive psychotherapist.
He's Googling it right now.
And in fact, one of my buddies from college actually got caught doing that. Well, he wasn't a psychotherapist. He was a family doctor. He was doing the gynecological exams a little more intensely than he ought to be.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. How horrifying.
Okay. So are we ready for the next question?
Well, I'm having a hard time transitioning from that one.
We're getting a little off topic.
Do you want to do the next? Do you want to give the next question?
I think it's your turn.
Oh, is it?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So next question. What do you think is the single most influential placebo? As in the one that most people don't realize is placebo and is either used the most or has the biggest effect on healthcare.
Well, there's lots of ways that you can make placebo more effective.
Right.
For example, a blue pill is more effective. I'm getting this wrong. Like a red pill and a blue pill. A blue pill, I think, works better for depression, or maybe a red pill works better for depression, and a blue pill works better for anxiety, or one or the other, anyways.
Right.
Or maybe a green pill works better for anxiety. A big pill works better than a small pill.
Right.
A bad tasting pill works better than a no tasting pill.
Huh.
An injection works better than a pill. You can basically, there's lots of different ways you can administer a placebo to increase its effectiveness. And for example, in my opinion, things like acupuncture,
right?
It's got everything. It's like awesome placebo effect.
Huh. Yeah, we talked about acupuncture on our episode, and I think when I first looked into it, I was surprised that it was a placebo. Even though I'm a skeptic, I thought that there might have been something to it, and I'm surprised.
I can't understand how it's a placebo. I mean, 4,000 years ago, they came up with this, so it has to be real.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I was skeptical of my skepticism.
And another one we talked about on the last episode was chiropractic medicine the placebo associated with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cracking your back.
Yeah.
Is a great way to induce placebo.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels good.
You got that sound, that visceral.
You walk out feeling great.
Feel loose. Yeah, it feels great.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
So moving on to the next one. Having something feel like it's helping, even if it isn't, is very pleasant. Sometimes we may think it's in a way a shame that we know as much about the placebo effect that we do and wonder if there are things that may not work on us, knowing it, kind of like hypnosis. If you go in with the wrong attitude, like this is stupid, it won't work, that it won't be as useful. So what's the right attitude to have about the placebo effect as a patient and as someone who knows about it?
When you give a placebo effect with deception, you don't have 100% response. The response is on average about one third.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe 20 to 40% are going to respond. And so because the patient A doesn't know, and your selection of that patient may have been good or it may not have been. And so you're not going to get an overwhelmingly positive response, right? If, however, you discuss giving a patient a placebo and you enlist the patient in the process of doing it, and they understand this and maybe even practice some relaxation techniques or some meditation or some hypnosis techniques, so that they can get into the practice of taking suggestion and use this, and they're wanting to do this, and they understand the whole concept behind it, and they're on board doing it. This is a patient
population then that would probably have a much higher rate of responding.
So in a way, going into it with the attitude that, oh, it's a nerd, it doesn't do anything, it's BS, it's not going to help, versus going into it realizing that it's a compensatory mechanism, mm-hmm. and that it can be useful if you utilize it correctly.
Like, for example, with hypnosis, people have this misperception because of television shows that hypnosis is the thing that I do to you,
yeah.
and like I wave mm-hmm. my fingers in front of you, electricity goes out and hits your head, mm. and you like walk in a trance.
Yeah.
No, all hypnosis is essentially self-hypnosis. If you don't want to do it, there's no way I can like snap my fingers and make you hypnotized, right?
Kind of like a meditation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but if you're willing and wanting to do hypnosis, then I can assist you in some sort of guided imagery or something to help you achieve a trance, state. But if you don't want to do it, I can't like put you into a trance and then tell you to go kill your mother.
Right.
You're not going to do that. Right? But I can only get you into the trance state if you want to do that.
Right.
And I can only suggest to you things that you kind of want to do. If you want to, if you really badly want to quit smoking, and you really badly want to do it through hypnosis, then I can put you in a trance and I can tell you to quit smoking, and I might have some success. But I cannot cause you to do stuff that you don't want to do through hypnosis, or I can't cause you to be in a trance if you don't want to be in a trance.
Yeah. Someone might want to kill their mother, so you want to be careful.
Don't even suggest it, because you never know.
But just be on the safe side.
But in my thinking, it's probably the same thing with placebo, is that I would much rather be working with a patient that fully understands it and is on board and wants to do it.
Well, I think the root of this question was, a lot of people that listen to this show are going to be skeptics. So they're going to know something about the placebo effect, etc. And I think the perspective of the skeptic is, going to be like, if I were to, we have a vitamin cottage around the corner from here. If I go there to buy something and I, walk down some of the aisles, I'm annoyed at the fact that there are these treatments claiming to do all these things, and it's lies. I'll say, oh, this is the placebo effect. And so we come to associate the placebo effect with a negative thing.
Yeah.
But what I'm thinking that you're, pointing out, which that I really like, is that there's nothing wrong with the placebo effect. What's wrong with it is the deception. It's the lying part that makes it wrong. And I think that makes perfect sense.
Well, with the vitamin store that you're talking about, there's a couple other issues that are really, really bad. I mean, the reason I hate that store is that I don't want somebody that genuinely has a thyroid problem going to that store and taking fake thyroid medicine.
Right. Just take a multivitamin.
Yeah, because the problem is that then they don't go and they get treatment that they ought to be getting, right?
Right.
So if you're going to use alternative medicine, or you're going to use any sort of placebo medicine, it needs to be with a real physician and a real physician's relationship, and other things that you could possibly have need to be ruled out, and real treatment needs to be given when it needs to be given, and the placebo needs to be used just for certain types of like pain and stuff like that, or nausea. Pain and nausea generally are the things that have been most well studied and most well proven to be most responsive to placebo.
Oddly enough, those are two things that are also responsive to marijuana use. I wonder if there's a correlation.
The marijuana effect?
Well, I'm out of questions, but I've learned a lot so far.
I have too. We're at about an hour.
Wow.
Wow, that went fast.
If there's anything else you'd like to bring up or talk about, I think that's a good conclusion to the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for coming. We like it.
Yeah. We learned a lot.
Good.
Nick, you want to close with us?
Of course. As I say at the end of every episode we do, please think responsibly and think happy. La 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 la